Horses with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
Back at the University of Arizona at the symposium, and just about a half hour to fill out this morning, and was trying to find Alan. There's quite a few people all getting ready to register here, but in the meantime, Hammer, you got a little...
I got a text here about 2 minutes ago resulting or having to do with some situation in Santa Anita, and I don't really want to talk about it until I doubly confirm it, but not some great news, possibly. We're looking for it to break somewhere else before we say anything, but somebody that knows somebody in Santa Anita might want to make a phone call and ask what's going on. Right?
Yeah, well, there's the speculation, not speculation. It's more than speculation. But I'd rather have. I know that Jay is away. Casey, call Steve Anderson. See if you can reach Steve, if you would, and we'll see about giving you details. It'll be clearly an overwhelming
situation.
Yeah,
and difficult. With what's going on today.
Yeah, and it'll dominate the conversation the rest of the day and the next few days.
They're lining up here to get registered.
Yeah.
We got Phil O'Hare over here, who was partner in getting the program back on his feet here after the COVID here. If we don't talk to him here today, we'll get to him later in the week, definitely, to tell us what's going on with the program here at Arizona, which is headed in the right direction. Did you see Alan walk by?
He texted me before and thought that we'd... have him here at right yeah at what is it yeah it's 11:30, so yeah, and just bear with us while we try to reach Steve.
You know, it's funny, I saw the headline Sir Winston wins, and I didn't realize he was still in training. The Breeders' Cup, well, not the Breeders' Cup, the Belmont winner from 2019, and, Mark Cassie, was that his first? He won the Will's Way?
Did he? War of Will.
War of Will. Won the Preakness.
Yeah.
And so, anyway.
And then the Preakness, then the Belmont, it's his first win since the Belmont.
But I'm glad to see him still around. I always liked that horse and actually cast a nice bet that day at a healthy 10, 12 to 1. So I always happy to see these old war horses sticking around a little bit. And that's what we talked about earlier, with the hope of some of the three-year-olds that are starting to bloom here later in the year that will carry on over into next year and hopefully become older horses in 22.
And He's been patient.
Speaking of Cassie, Norm Cassie is taking stalls at Oakland this year for the first time.
I didn't realize
that. Yeah, so he entered a few horses the other day and just started to ship some of his string in, so decided to take a look. And not only him, here's Alan right here. I didn't know if he was headed to the gym or the golf course. But here, sit right down here, Alan Foreman.
Thank you.
You got spin that around now. There we go. Beautiful. Well done. Alan Foreman, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
If we go, once the Alan Foreman bat signal goes up, there's always another three or four things that stack up immediately. My first call to you was involving the situation at Laurel. And it did seem, even though they canceled Friday, Saturday, Sunday, it did seem that they were confident about coming back because they let people train. What can you tell everybody about what's going on?
Well, it's light training right now. We believe we've identified the problem. We are taking corrective measures. We are attempting to secure materials that will be added to the cushion at Laurel. Excuse me. I think some of the material that came in isn't of the consistency that we need. So we're working on the materials. They will be added to the cushion. We've put a pad in. We've strengthened the pad. So the cushion will go on top of the pad. And we'll, once that is done, we've deepened the cushion. The consistency is much thicker. The maintenance is different. We will allow the horses to start training time workouts and the like. That will be sometime, hopefully, this week. We're not going to allow the horses back into the starting gate until the experts confer and we're satisfied that it is safe to race on that surface again. We're not going to risk any more. We're not going to risk any more breakdowns, and certainly the injuries are something that concern us also.
So confident that there was a problem at that. At the middle of the,
but it's more widespread than that, Steve.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was in other places. I mean, essentially, the cushion was simply not suitable as the weather changed. When they put the new cushion down, it was great for summer racing. The weather changed. There were some changes to maintenance, and the surface became too silky, and the horses were getting down to the sub base. It was. When you see clusters of breakdowns, it's when the red flags go up. We've learned that going back a decade. We started to see the cluster. Breakdowns are multifactorial. We started to look at everything. We have an equine medical director in Maryland. We've implemented the Mid-Atlantic protocols that we've gotten everyone in the region to do, and we started to investigate and determine that the problem was the track surface. And we brought the top experts in. Glenn Kozak came down from New York. John Passero, former track superintendent. Mick Peterson, Dennis Moore. We've had everybody. And I think we're in concurrence as to what needs to be done to correct the problem.
That's a relief. The horsemen, I know, were also getting frustrated, the turf course, some inability to use the turf course on a regular basis.
Well, you know, we're using these surfaces on a year-round basis.
Which wasn't intended.
Right. In Maryland, we used to have four racetracks. We used to run at four tracks. We consolidated from four to three, three to two, and now we're essentially consolidating to one. And the turf course was an issue this year. It needed freshening. We didn't have the opportunity to freshen it. We're doing that now. And we're going to have to look at a totally new maintenance program for both the dirt and the turf courses, since we're running on them year-round, to ensure that they are the best and safest possible. And there's no wavering in that commitment at all.
Well, it's the challenges, Alan, don't ever seem to abate, and it doesn't seem like you can ever go too long without a new difficulty. The one this morning, which you have unlikely not. The report from the West Coast, from Santa Anita, is that Medina Spirit either suffered a cardiac incident this morning or broke down physically, and we've got Rick. You talked a little bit to the West Coast. We're trying to reach for Steve Anderson, but the confirmation seemed too widespread to.
I just got a text minutes ago when we were alluding to a situation at Santa Anita, and this is totally just a text from someone out there that said, looks like a heart attack working. So I'm not, that's all I'm going to tell you, that's what was said. And obviously, as Steve alluded to, this will be the story of the day, and we'll go on for a while, but we'll get the facts straight. But we didn't want to say anything until we heard. I made a call, and they said yes, and now it's going a little bit over Twitter. We haven't seen it on any of the trade publication websites just yet, but that's the word out of Southern California at the moment. Pretty sad news.
Well, there will be red flags. There will be certain things that will be looked at when you're dealing with sudden deaths of young horses. And certainly, I'm sure, Dion Benson is the equine medical director for the Strana Group out in Santa Anita. We'll be on top of that one very quickly. Sudden deaths were something that we experienced in the Mid-Atlantic a year or so ago. We jumped on it. We implemented some protocols and measures, and they have been significantly reduced, if not eliminated. So that's just really sad news. I mean, it just that's really sad.
There's seemingly Alan no benefit to. I was certainly going to, under other circumstances, ask you, what could be gleaned from Clark Brewster's press release over the weekend regarding the testing of the urine sample, and what even confirmation of the topical being the source of the betamethasone, what it was going to mean. I don't even know if it's worth even discussing, frankly, but I mean what would have been your thoughts under the other difficult circumstances?
I hate speculating.
Yeah.
And I'm not involved in this case, and it seems like it takes twists and turns. I mean, this has taken so long. I think part of the problem was there was a belief within the community that this explanation of a topical cream for a rash that that the horse had was what caused the positive test. There were others who said, no, it was an injectable. They're just not telling you the truth. And so probably from the standpoint of trying to figure out whether it was cream or whether it was an injectable is an important thing to know. But at the end of the day, it's the presence of a drug in a horse's system post-race that is a violation of the rules. The guidelines for betamethasone are solely with respect to injectable. That doesn't mean that because there is no guidance given for a topical that it's legal. You can't give guidance with respect to topicals because it's almost impossible to know the exact dose, amount of administration, location, whatever. So, for example, lidocaine. Lidocaine is a prohibited substance. Lidocaine is an injectable. And lidocaine is a topical. And historically in our industry, if you went to CVS and you bought aloe vera cream with lidocaine, aloe vera with lidocaine, and they advertise it, it's right on the label, and you rub it on a horse that has a rash or a burn or some kind of a infection, and it gets into the bloodstream, it's a violation of the rules. It's there. And so I guess the debate now is going to be, does it matter whether it was a cream or whether it was an injectable? And if it was a cream and it was a topical and it is a violation of the rules, do you disqualify the horse? Well, in most jurisdictions you do. And then you mitigate the penalty. If it was a cream and not an injectable, then you mitigate the penalty. The Baffert team is arguing that it's a non-violation. I think we'll all be interested to see what the Kentucky Racing Commission has to say about it. But I know what it would be in New York. I know what it would be in Maryland. I know what it would be in other jurisdictions.
And Al, let me ask you, and I have to ask this all the time, why so long for an initial, you know, initial reaction, initial penalty? Give the penalty or don't give the penalty and let the appeal process take its course. We haven't even had anything to appeal yet.
Well, my understanding is that the judge, you know, Baffert's team went to court seeking injunctive relief to allow for further testing of the sample. And the judge stepped in and allowed it. And I think the delay has been solely because the court has stopped the administrative process from moving forward. I mean, this should have been disposed of quite some time ago. And Judge Wingate, in his ruling, said, look, I don't know whether it's going to make a difference to the racing commission or not, whether it was a cream or whether it was an injectable, but I'm going to give them the opportunity to at least establish. And that's what's caused the delay here.
Let me use that as a segue, Alan, because over the next 2 days, there's going to be extensive conversation about HESA and the various administrative elements of it. What in their construct that we've seen to this point would ameliorate a situation like this?
Well, we don't know, because we're all struggling with trying to understand the USADA protocols. But it would require, first of all, a determination of whether or not we're dealing with a primary substance or a secondary substance. We haven't seen a therapeutic list, so we don't know what the secondary substances are, but we assume they're therapeutic. There is a different way of handling cases depending upon whether they're a primary substance or a secondary substance. And a secondary substance may be adjudicated initially following an investigation by a steward selected from a board of stewards who will make a decision, offer the trainer a penalty and the owner, and they can take that penalty or they can appeal it, in which case they go into an arbitration process. If you're dealing with a primary substance, you're dealing with a case that automatically goes to and through the arbitration process. And we can't determine, at least at first blush, how long those procedures will take, but they're suggesting that they will be expedited compared to what we're currently doing. I'm not so sure about that, because 98% of our medication violations are expedited very quickly in our current system. I think the thing that people complain about is the lack of uniformity in penalties, not so much the delays that are incurred when cases are appealed, because not that many are appealed. So without having a better understanding of what USADA is proposing, and if the authority board is going to partner with USADA, we simply don't know. We're looking at charts right now trying to explain the protocols, because none of us understand the protocols. And it's very tough to determine what the procedural process would be. So it's like a non-answer, I guess, I'm giving you. Not comfortable with trying to opine on that.
From what you understand, what is going to be presented from their two parallel track operating committees?
Well, we're bumping up against the first deadline. It's the deadline that requires the authority to submit its proposed regulations and protocols for public comment. We've been in a pre-comment period up until this time, and they have been rolling out various regulations, both from the Anti-Doping and Medication Committee and the Safety and Welfare Committee, and groups and individuals within the industry have been giving pre-comment with respect to what's been rolled out so far. The safety committee has been making changes on a weekly basis. We get a new version almost every week, incorporating recommendations and comments from those of us in the industry. We have seen little to no changes with respect to the medication and anti-doping protocols, and they are the ones causing the most heartburn right now. It is very, it's creating a lot of undercurrent, simply because most of us in the industry can't follow them. They're, it's not that they're unintelligible, they're just very difficult to navigate. And what USADA is proposing to do is to shoehorn into our business the way that they handle the sports that they regulate in the human sport, and they don't necessarily marry, and they don't marry well, and it's going to be teaching a new language to those in the industry who are going to be regulated by it. And it's, I think there's, quite frankly, been widespread opposition to what's been proposed so far. And I think that creates a real dilemma for the authority board.
Well, they HISA, is it HISA or HISA? So
I call it HISA. Some people call it HISA.
So they sent out a paper a month ago asking for comments from various racing executives, boards, things like that. And I'm hoping that I know they got responses because everybody I talked to wrote nice, big, thick responses. And I'm hoping that they did this to gather information and maybe sit down and go, maybe we should include some other people in these discussions and maybe soften some of the things that they're intending on doing. I hope against hope that's what it's about. But, they did send out comments. I know that I've talked to half a dozen track executives that literally told me we had to cut our list in half of sending in, suggestions against what they're recommending.
I mean, look, the original Horse Racing Integrity Act, would have put USADA in charge of doping and medication control in horse racing. There was a widespread opposition to that part of the original bill. And so, and that bill never got out of committee. And so the version that passed that we're now dealing with treated USADA, we believe, in a different way. We saw USADA or someone like USADA as an entity that we could use it as an enforcement agency. That is, take our rules and help us to better enforce them, oversee better drug testing, create an investigative force, create more uniform administration of justice, so to speak, within our system. It was never intended to empower USADA to rewrite the rule book. I've never heard criticism of RCI's rule book, and I've never heard criticism about the rules. What we've heard is criticism about the way they've been patchwork implemented and the manner in which our system doesn't mete out uniform justice throughout the industry. A ruling in one jurisdiction is different than a ruling in another jurisdiction. And they wanted uniformity. We never intended that USADA would rewrite our rule book. And what they've done is they've taken a system that everybody understands and that nobody really complains about, and they've tossed it away and are implementing what they do in the human sport. And it's very confusing. We're still waiting for information that we have not seen that's the most relevant information of all, and that is, you know, medication control, which we do on a daily basis. What's permitted, what's not permitted, under what circumstances, how are we going to train our horses, what are we allowed to do when we enter these horses to race? And all we have is just a confusing pages and pages of regulations that nobody understands, and they don't weave together very well for us.
We're hoping that tomorrow, Tuesday, they have three or four, I don't know if to call them workshops, people, you know, from HISA getting up and talking. I don't know if it's a question and answer situation, but hopefully some of those things can be answered, because I know there's going to be a lot of hands going up when they say they have any questions.
Well, they're going to tell you that they've got charts that will explain it, and it's not as overly complicated as people make it out to be, and that this system is going to work better. It's going to be more uniform. I have yet to speak to anyone in the industry, and we're dealing with teams of experts who are poring over these regulations, who understand them. I mean, I've tried three and four times, and I just, you know, you just have to stop at some point, because there's so many definitions, so many cross-references, so many section references to other sections, so many missing underlying documents, that it's almost impossible to give an opinion on it, because you simply can't get through it. And there are people who are a lot smarter than me in this business and have been in the business a long time who are having the same problem. But it's a universal issue.
There's not too many people smarter than you in the industry. Yeah. Let's clarify that.
Yeah. And, you know, we want a system that works. I mean, if they had started with the RCI model rules, which everybody has, everybody knows, everybody understands, and then start to attack those weaknesses that we know exist, whether it's with USADA or with someone else, that would have been the appropriate approach to do it. But when you come in with a sledgehammer and you're starting a new entity, we haven't seen the costs yet. That's just going to be a whole other issue.
That's another topic.
The safety committee, you've got large tracks and small tracks. When you adopt protocols, you want everybody to be able to do it. You don't want to put the small tracks out of business because you put requirements on them that they simply cannot meet, yet you want them to be safer environments. So the safety committee has been very responsive, and that's a work in process and progress, and we're pleased with the way that's developing. The anti-doping and medication committee, it has really, there's a tremendous undercurrent in the industry that could, I think, create major problems for the authority in trying to launch.
Why has there not? I've asked this repeatedly since the conversation I had with you and then two days later with Matt Hegarty. There has been no formal response from pro or con, frankly, from any entity. Do you think that's by design, or is everybody, you say that you're hearing from, you know, behind the scenes, essentially, some pushback. It hasn't manifested itself outwardly yet, but...
The THA and experts that we've brought together to work with us so that we could provide constructive comment, pre-comment, have weighed in writing and will continue to do so.
Why has that not been made public?
Well, I think all of those documents do become public. I don't think that there's a record or a letter or a submission that goes to the authority that isn't public or doesn't become public. I mean, I've seen a letter from the members of the Thoroughbred Safety Coalition, which are your leading tracks and Breeders' Cup, and they have taken issue with the approach that is proposed by USADA. So there is...
Well, that's encouraging.
Groups are weighing in.
That's encouraging.
And it's, again, we created this to try to make the industry better. It doesn't serve us well to implement a system that creates chaos, impose such costs that it may, you know, cripple the effort. You know, the regulators are not on board with this. If the regulators are not on board, this will not and cannot work. And I think that Ed Martin has been very clear in the regulators that the way this is being proposed is not workable for them, and they may just walk away.
The quarter horse and standard bred people, where are they in all of this?
Oh, I don't. The statute provides for states that regulate those breeds to either opt them in to HISA or out. And HISA at least has taken a preliminary position that they don't want to deal with standard breds and quarter horse until they have gotten consensus on the thoroughbred rules. So we're told they're not dealing with it right now, but it's coming. But that doesn't work for jurisdictions, Maryland, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, that have a single commission that regulates both standard bred
right.
and thoroughbred.
Right.
So take Maryland, for example, or New York. So we're going to have a HISA system for the thoroughbreds, and that's supposed to be cost-effective through HISA. But, oh, by the way, since HISA is not going to regulate the standard bred industry, you got to keep your whole framework in place, including drug testing and otherwise, because HISA is not doing it. The commission has to do it. It makes no sense. And part of the problem here is that the timeline really doesn't allow for a methodical approach to getting this right. Because of the requirements of the Federal Administrative Procedures Act, you have to propose regulations by a deadline. You have to have a public comment period. You bring them back. You reconsider. You make them final. And we're dealing with July 1, 2022. We're, you know, what, 7 months?
Not even, yeah.
Seven months to do all of this.
Plus
set up a whole new system, including the cost to do it. Who's going to work for whom? Is the Equine Medical Director in New York going to work for HISA, or is he going to work for the New York Gaming Commission? If the New York Gaming Commission opts out of HISA, who does he work for? He doesn't go to work for HISA. Who's going to do all of the, the retrieval of samples from the horses post-race? Who's going to do the pre-race inspections of horses to determine who's at risk? I mean, you go right down the line. And it seems to me the best approach would have been to take what we have right now, begin with that, and build in reform.
Is there a chance that they could take a step back, do you think, and take that approach?
I think they're probably at decision time on what approach to take because of the time frame. So they will be proposing regulations beginning, I think, this week and over the next couple weeks because of the various timelines and requirements for public comment. I think the most important period will be the comment period and to see how they react to the comments, because the Federal Trade Commission requires, federal agencies require there to be informed decisions when adopting regulations. So they're going to have to justify in writing why they did what they did. Did they take into consideration the comments coming from the industry and the public, and how did they address those comments?
Does feasibility come into that equation? In other words, yeah, they can ask for this, but if it's not feasible, can that make sense to try and follow through with this thing? They can't be happy with the, you know, widespread opposition to their initial paper.
Well, you just got to remember one thing. This system goes into effect on July 1, 2022.
Come hell or high water.
Come hell or high water.
Well, there's also a legal challenge that is going to come to a head.
And I will tell you, I initially thought the legal challenges probably were not going to be successful. But watching what the Fifth Circuit is doing on cases involving states' rights versus federal rights, and seeing the shift of the Supreme Court and, quite frankly, the shift of the federal government to state rights, I'm not so sure one of these cases might not be successful.
That seems to be a growing feeling in that direction. We're going to have to pull up. But, Alan, very timely across the board. Hammer will be back tomorrow, obviously, 21 hours from now. If anybody missed anything, replay tomorrow, 6 to 9, here on Sirius XM and archive podcast, etc. I want to thank Hammer, of course, Rich Migliori, and Tony Black to explain what went on when it came to Errat Ortiz, and more Sal Sinatra with some insight into where Equibase is heading, hopefully in the right direction, and Alan Foreman just now, and of course the backdrop in the last half hour news of Medina Spirit suffering a cardiac incident after working out. That'll create a gigantic new firestorm. Hard to believe. Talk to you tomorrow, everybody. Thanks.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only 3 states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.